EMS on the Mountain is an entertainment, educational, and commentary product recorded by Sean and Mike and produced by them. Nothing recorded by Sean, Mike, or any of the guests of the show is endorsed nor authorized by their respective employers or agencies unless explicitly outlined. All commentary and statements made are their own. Always follow your respective medical protocols. Nothing said on this platform should be considered medical direction. Now, on with the show.
Welcome to the EMS on the Mountain podcast, a show for those interested in austere and wilderness medicine. This podcast provides insight into the unique aspects and challenges of bringing modern EMS into wilderness and austere environments.
And welcome back to another episode of EMS on the Mountain.
That's usual, my new goal, like, to make you laugh every time there's an intro.
Yes, because you haven't been able to do it in the last however many 50-something, 60 episodes.
Seriously, dude. Go die.
So, as you can all tell, yes, Mike is still here. For this week, though, you can hear a new laugh in the background, and we're joined again by Mr. Jason Tarcolone, who you remember, I think, last year we had on as a guest on the podcast. We'll let Jason introduce himself again here shortly, but he owns Sergeant Rescue and Training, and he also has his own podcast, The Rogue Medic. And Jason, with that, you can introduce yourself again, I suppose.
Yeah, sounds good, guys. Appreciate you having me back on. We've been trying to do this for a hot minute. Just like schedules never lined up, so it's all good. But yeah, and I run Sergeant Rescue Training Consulting, and I run the Rogue Medic podcast, but it's always nice to get different opinions and have different conversations with like-minded individuals. So last time we had a blast. I'm hoping to have one here too.
All right, then.
We need a better definition of fun, I think. Go ahead, Bunyan.
Well, I was going to say that one of my leading themes in life is they don't pay me enough to have a bad time. And as this podcast, this raked in considerable sums of nothing. So if this wasn't fun, I just wouldn't even be here.
He'd be a quitter.
Fair enough.
All right, Mike, what are we talking about?
All right, what are we talking about? Nope. I'm making you guys tell me what we're talking about. I'm just here for the party.
Chasing you guys to have a conversation about some road rescue stuff, just because I think we share a lot of the same background. So one of the things that popped up that I figured we could have a decent conversation on was like the concept of redundancy in rope rescue, because from my side of things and my world of how I play in the woods is we look at it from a very different perspective than a lot of the structure guys. And like, you see all the pictures from like these structural training courses, and there's 8 ropes to do the same thing of 2 and like double freaking anchor plates and 7 carabiners do the job of 1, like all that kind of fun stuff. And I'm not necessarily saying it's not worthwhile. It's just like, where is it actually important, and potentially where we can look at physics and actually see if this is necessary or not.
Dude, I'll say it. It's not worth it. It's over complication and redundancy for the sake of redundancy.
Well, and I would say that if you look at this same group of, if you're following any of this stuff and you look at the photos of stuff, even all the folks in the woods are letting the fireside bleed in, and you're starting to see, you know, a single rescuer going down with 3 different ropes.
Mm-hmm.
For the sake of redundancy, and it's starting to get mind-boggling. Oh, come on. There's a reason that you and I get negative reviews at a certain program I used to teach at. You'll be back because you're diehard. But
you have so little faith in me.
I know where you're going, but we would get complaints because this is something that, yeah, there's a certain time and place, I believe, for redundancy of certain parts of a system and things, right? But there are organizations that are letting redundancy just become, if one is good, then 3 must be better kind of things. And they're not even, you can't even ask them for a cogent answer as to why you needed to do all of these extra pieces. And it's just for safety. And I think Mike would agree, but you get to a certain point and the more ropes and complexity you add into these systems and you start losing that safety, because now I'm looking at, yeah, like you're saying, Jason, I'm looking at multiple rating plates and I'm like, wait, what does this one even go to? Is this part of the same thing, or is this a different thing? And trying to figure out where everything's connected and why. And then it's, yeah, it just, I think it adds a bit of complexity where there certainly doesn't need to.
From what I understand, like the idea of redundancy came out of the idea of when we were doing main and belay, and something was always slack. So there was never that concept of something is actually catching it. We're shock loading one side, we're shock loading the other side once it fails. And that's my understanding of where redundancy came from, is finding those single points of failure that are critical and backing them up. And that's where we went to TTRS, where both lines are sharing that same load. And so if one side fails, the other side's already tensioned. So there isn't that shock load, is where I understood it came from.
Yeah, I would say you're probably pretty correct in that. And this goes.
So I would describe it differently, but I think you're poking at the same, at the correct direction, right? So the concept was that in an old school twin tension system, there are always two ropes for different purposes, right? A main and a belay. So there was the primary and a backup. Then we moved to twin tension systems where we fundamentally wanted to tension both lines. Same fundamental principled concept. I don't know exactly when the world of, oh my gosh, we need to have all these extra ropes came from. I will tell you that I know for a fact the NFPA has a minimum of a 10-to-1 T-factor mathematical calculational requirement that is typically not required in a wilderness environment. If you're an NFPA following department, and even those that don't will say they do. So I don't know of an agency that doesn't, that's like the NFPA, they can suck it. So they're operating under a different standard to begin with. Most traditional rope work systems operate on a standard of 5-to-1 as the load requirement. Now, about 6, 7, 8, 10-ish years ago, this concept of one rope has to be able to hold all the things in motion under shock load and all the stuff all the time started creeping into the world. And I don't know where that came from, but I'm also old. Like really old. Like I know what Gold Line is.
Yep. Have you ever used it?
Back of the day when I first joined the program that I'd been a part of for a long time, some of our ropes were still Gold Line, but it was also an underfunded government agency that was holding out of gear for way too long too. When I grew up, the concept was that you had a main and a belay. And then if there was a problem with the main, the load could be statically held on the belay line. It was not meant to become the main line, right? You would be introducing more ropes and more equipment to then move the load if there was a failure in the primary. Now we want everything to be completely capable of hauling the entire system, but we use two of them all the time. I'm fine with that. I think, as much as I hate to say it, I think a second rope oftentimes is useful, especially in education, right? Screwing up and falling hurts. I will also say that it's really hard to disconnect yourself from a rope when there's only one of them. If you're attached to a rope and you're going up the rope and you attempt to disconnect from said rope, it's really hard to do if you're following the simple principles of two points of contact at all time, et cetera, et cetera. But shit happens. People do stupid things. So belays I'm okay
I'm
with.
A fan.
Beyond that, all the redundant hardware needs to go. Throw it all away.
Yeah. Well, I'm a fan of the TTRS systems. I think, yeah, it's got extra parts and pieces. But like when you look at the concept of if the main disappeared and 9 times out of 10, the belay was always slack because the belay person's like half-assing it, not really paying attention. Like
I resemble that.
I've caught myself doing it myself, but I understand that. And it's, yeah, I agree with you. I think a lot of it comes out of education where we're dealing with folks that aren't practiced, aren't well-versed, are still learning it for the first time. And it's, oh, I think this carabiner goes over here and they pull it out of the system and then something falls apart.
But that also happens because you have too many damn pieces in the puzzle, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fair enough.
Slow, smooth is fast, as simple is always better. I just made that up. That's a horrible statement. Nobody should ever use that. This and in the rope world, like in the context of ropes, yeah, some redundancy is probably a good idea. right? As a general rule of thumb, adding more hardware doesn't make anything more redundant. It makes it heavier and bigger and cumbersome.
And we work in the world of lightweight systems where it's one carabiner's got to do the job of three to begin with. We aren't carrying 10 extra carabiners for the sake of carrying extra stuff. That adds up quick.
And we operate in the world of one carabiner does the job of one carabiner.
Yeah, very true. Very true.
In one carabiner for three different jobs, you're probably done fucked up. But you don't need three carabiners when one will do.
One will do. Yeah, I guess that's what I was digging at.
If you're using it as the anchor plate and the belay line and you're using it for your mother, yeah, you're probably done fucked up. That's not a good idea. But you don't need extra hardware for the purpose of having extra hardware.
Yep. Well, I think the CMC guys said it pretty well. They actually pointed out that in NFPA, NFPA doesn't actually apply to any of the mountain rescue, wilderness, backcountry kind of stuff. It's right in their own standard, which is cool that they pointed that out. I actually looked it up. It's in there. It's like chapter 40, something like that in 10.06 or some shit, or in the new 2500. I'd have to do the reference again.
But somebody looked it up because Lord knows I did.
But system failure is possible, but it's one of those things where we're supposed to be building things so they don't fail and building things for the things that we are doing and appropriate for what we're doing. And even in some of the, can't remember which field guide it is, they even have one rope's good enough for this, two ropes for this, and then like maybe a rope for like low angle if you really need it to keep balance, or it's like muddy or snowy or something like that. So I think some of that kind of comes into play here too, where it's, do we have to actually do the thing we're doing, or are we doing it just because we have the stuff?
Well, I think people get into the, I like the stuff piece because I carried this out here, by God, we're going to use it.
Yeah.
And so they want to use the stuff. But I think one of the things that's just a personal observation is a lot of organizations let their training practices and the safety pieces they put into their training programs lead into their operational side. And we talk about like those new people on rope and everything else. And so, yeah, you're going to be on rope, but we're going to give you this extra belay line just in case you forget how whatever thing you're using doesn't work, or you get stuck or hung up. We've got this extra line for you, and we're going to make sure that you're safe when you're doing these things. We might have some extra belay or extra ropes put in with litters and other things. And they're supposed to be kept in a training context only. And then people start to think that's just the way they do it. And next thing you're on an actual operational rescue and the single rope for a provider or a technician going down suddenly still has to become two or maybe a third because we're going to have a belay. Plus we want you on this other one with an ASAP and something else absurd. And I think it falls into that training scar piece where we train and we have these extra redundant pieces for training because we don't want to have anybody get hurt in just a training evolution. And then these younger people just grow up always doing it this way. And then when the operational event comes, they're like, oh, but I need this extra rope for me for this. And we need an extra one over here for this. And next thing you're building these systems that have just too much in them again, because we're used to making training, in my opinion, sometimes too safe. And I said that out loud. And people just bring over some of the things that
you're dying.
Yeah, dude.
It turns out that doing dangerous things is inherently dangerous, and you can only mitigate so much risk.
Yeah.
I heard helicopters are dangerous too. We should probably quit using them.
They fall out of the sky on occasion.
Yeah. Everyone. Okay. I think pretty quickly we got to the answer of too much redundancy is dumb. But I think we need to quantify or define the definition of too much redundancy. So let's break it up into two parts. Are we talking about haul systems, or are we talking about independent individual rope access? Because those are two different problems, right? Individual rope access, I'm on the fence. Sean knows damn well that I am not a big old redundant rope seller. In fact, he's seen me do things that were probably stupid. It was in the interest of life-saving maneuvers. Ladies and gentlemen, I wasn't just being dumb to be dumb. Actually, I should probably say this. I wasn't going to say this, but I will say this. Yes, there are some people that are probably listening to this podcast, because there's seven of you now, that have seen me do things that make them uncomfortable. I've been doing this a long time, and I made a calculated risk, or I have made decisions based on my understanding of physics and ropes and such, that I was comfortable doing that for myself, in the interest of providing patient care to people on cliffs. That doesn't mean that you should do it, but it does mean you need to have a real foundational knowledge of what you're rigging and how it works, and not just do what Bobby told me to do. And I'm starting to feel like I'm falling into one of my preach sessions about medicine too. I was doing airway training with somebody the other day, and she's a great medic. Like she squared away, but I got frustrated at one point because I kept asking questions, like trying to lead her toward answers. Like, how long do we, here's the scenario. I said, all right, what's the first step we're going to take before we intubate somebody? And they were giving me the prepare your equipment. And I was like, no, we need to pre-oxygenate the patient.
Yeah.
And then I said, why? And they said, that's what the protocol says. And I got hot and I was like, yeah, are you a practitioner of medicine or are you a book follower? And the same rules apply to understanding rigging. If your agency has policies and you're going to get fired for not following the policies, and if you would like to stay gainfully employed, you should probably follow the rules. But it is okay to go ask the questions of why was that rule made and what was the original foundational principle that drove that rule. There's often really good reasons behind those things. But we have fallen into the world of you've got to have two ropes because that's what I was taught. And nobody is understanding the physics or the friction coefficient or anything else related to it. And that's where we're falling down. So for individual access on a rope, I'm on the fence. There are a lot of activities in this world where two ropes is kind of productive and one could argue potentially dangerous. Caves is a really good example. If you're listening to this podcast and you know anything about ropes, you understand what a friction hitch is. And two ropes in a free-hanging environment can quickly become a friction hitch. And so a lot of practitioners of free-hanging practice, arborists is another really good example. Do not use two ropes, because if you're hanging in midair and you're slowly spinning, you will eventually prusik yourself. Well, not prusik. You're going to friction hitch yourself into a bad way, where then you can't go up or down because your ropes are tangled. I think that applies to rescue to a certain extent as well. Now, if your agency has a policy like mine does, where you have to have two ropes at all times, I absolutely positively follow that rule until I don't. But I follow that rule. But for haul systems where we are moving non-compliant individuals, compliance is not the right term, non-engaged individuals, and the failure of any one particular piece of equipment is going to be catastrophic, right? Free, like gravity's persistent, rocks are always hard. Hate that thing, but I just said it anyway. Yeah, you should probably have some redundancy. But again, this comes back to understanding your equipment and understanding the science and the maths. This is more maths than science. Like, it's a little bit of physics, but if something is ready to carry 2,000 billion kilonewtons, two of them is not better than one. It's just not. The only thing that I really worry about redundancy in is soft goods and sharp things that can damage soft goods. That's really the place I care. Vectors are very important. That's how you get failures of equipment, is you vector the shit out of them in an inappropriate manner and they break. But adding a second rigging plate because, well, that's what the rules say, doesn't buy you anything and you just carry more crap around. I'll stop preaching now. Thoughts? Opinions?
There's definitely, I agree with the software piece, especially where we got points of rub where you're excessively vectoring or there's going to be movement. I was taught on individual skills on a single rope, and for probably the better part of 2 decades, that's how it was. So like when you look at the physics,
2 decades,
I'm getting there, man. I'm getting there. But yeah, it's like in the classes that I teach, we throw in the load cells. Okay. So we throw the load cell in there and we're seeing 2.6 kilonewtons with literally 5 people hanging on the same rope. What's going to fail? And that's in that scenario, fucking nothing. We're moving them up and we're lowering them down and we're hitting maybe 3 in like the worst possible scenario that we have, which is, I think we had 5 people hanging on the end of the twin tension system through the load cell in between the anchor plate that was holding everything together and the actual anchor itself. And we saw 3.4 kilonewtons with trying to move those guys in space, you know? Yeah, we're not balancing or anything like that, or adding that like theoretical shock load to the system. But again, I fall back on, we engineer things not to do that. And if we engineer things not to do that, then it's, we've basically mitigated that factor minus some sort of factory defect and catastrophic failure because of that. And those can't be prevented. We can plan for it, but we can't prevent it. That's where I sit here, and there's the theoretical physics that we tend to teach, which aren't actually accurate in a lot of classes because we can't teach complex physics. And I don't know about you guys, but I'm not smart enough to teach complex physics.
Don't sell yourself short, but you too can be a, what the hell is it called? A tenured professor.
The Stephen Hawking of rope rescue.
Yeah.
That's where I fall back on the load cell, man. It's like, what's the number tell me?
Yeah. It kind of goes into, there's an app for that. Let me make a thing that'll tell me how much of a load I've got on here.
Yep.
Shakira taught me numbers don't lie. Oh, no, that was hips. My bad. There it is. Finally got
it. And it steers back on topic. I would agree with Jason on individuals on single ropes. I can tend to envision a scenario in an operational context where an individual going down a rope, basically for any purpose, whether it's to go up or down, needs a second line. Unless you've got some stupid, sketchy, weird shit going on. In one of those, you're anchoring to tiny bushes and you're just really not sure if that root ball's going to hold.
Hey, I resemble that comment.
You and I both, we're two different little bushes, but yours was the more robust one.
Here's the scenario where it happens. Here's how this happens. And I don't mean to say that this all happened because lawyers got involved. It's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is accidents happen with soft good management or soft good damage foundationally two reasons. One, piss poor edge management, right? You're hurrying, you don't pad properly, you didn't account for fall lines, you didn't account for where the rope was going to be, it's going to rub on something you didn't account for, you weren't planning on, and you weren't paying attention. Combined with, and we're talking about individual rope skills here, but this applies to all systems as well. Combined with, I'll use the term piss poor technique. A lot of bouncing, a lot of jerking, rappelling where you're bounding as opposed to just slowly lowering. That's how you end up putting shock loads into the system. And that's, you should try it sometime, Jason. This will be a fun exercise. Go out and put a load cell on some rope. And then as opposed to smoothly descending, bound. Get the bounce in there. You're going to get that to 7-8x easy. Because force times mass, or force times acceleration, or whatever the hell that math problem is. You should probably know that. Same rules apply to the presentation we saw the other day around coup contra coup, right? Like, how many times were people in car accidents that were going 60 miles an hour, and then they stop, and then they get out, and they're like, I feel fine, I'm going to wave. Your brain was going 62, and then it bounced off your skull a few times. Same exact sort of concept, because this is a medical podcast, so I keep bringing up medicine. Same exact concept applies to shock loads on soft goods. On edges. Now here's the kicker. Is it better to tie a second rope to somebody who's exercising poor technique, or is it better to teach people to use proper technique to not shock load the system?
Well, see, that's where your argument then falls in line with trees that evaporate. Because
I was waiting for that.
What if I don't know how deep the root ball goes on this oak, and what if the trees have suddenly just fall over today because this is the day it's going to happen, because does happen in nature. Trees just fall over.
They do.
Right? So now we're doubling up on all the things that can be doubled up on.
Mm-hmm.
Because you never know. And this is where you get into trouble with the mindset of, well, I might need this. So now your pack starts getting bigger and bigger because I might need this. Mm-hmm. You know, if you've got that person who hasn't been trained, then I would argue they shouldn't be going down the rope in the operational context of a single rope. That person still should be in training. Even if your team is that small and we got to do the shits, if that's the only person you've got available, then put two ropes and lower them. Don't even give them a choice to bound.
I'm going to disagree, but I want to know what Jason thinks before I tell you're wrong.
We lost him.
You got me back.
There you are.
Green froze for a second. I missed something.
I was going to sum it up. So Sean just made the comment that people that don't know how to use good technique. People that don't know how to use good technique should not be
No.
Oh, okay.
In the operational context, when you should be on a single rope, not in training or anything else. I'm saying when it comes time to execute the deal, your most junior person who has no idea what they're doing shouldn't be the one you're pushing down. And if they are, you're worried that much about them, I'm saying then just lower them. Don't let them be in control of their own destiny at that point.
Nah, I agree with that.
Get behind that piece.
I can get that.
Yep. Like I was saying, if you got a small team, there's three of us. Okay, you got to take the two dudes that can really rig the system and prepare, we'll call the math part. And you're a qualified medical person to take care of this. You've been down rope once before. And if you're not sure they can execute this part of it, then maybe you should just set up a lower and lower that person.
Yeah.
That you know where that rope's going. They're not going to bounce on it. They're not going to induce additional stresses. Or if you've got the depth in your bench on your team, okay, it's not your turn yet. You have not demonstrated proficiency in this particular skill in this environment. And we're not comfortable putting you on a single rope right now and saying go and counting on you not messing.
I think that's fair.
Right?
Yeah. I think in our space, we see that more often, the whole single rescuer technique kind of piece happened because we're working in smaller teams. It's been a structure side thing for at least up this direction and a little bit out west where they're lowering people, period, just because they're like dealing with folks that are panicking on the side of buildings or in fire situations where it's like everybody's panicking. They're preparing for that leap. The guy's going to jump out the window at you. So if you're in control of a descent control device at the same time, and quicker ride and less control. And then just back to the jump. Yeah. Then back to the disappearing tree thing. I actually have to worry about that. It's when the roots burn away, sometimes the trees are just hanging there and we start applying force and now they're coming at us. But it's pretty rare. It's still pretty rare.
So there, Sean, trees do evaporate magically.
They don't. Or
they don't.
But
yeah.
But it goes back into another operational context, right?
Yeah.
If you're like Jason, for those who don't remember, he does a lot of wildland fire support. And so if that's the environment you work in, that's one of those known hazards, then that's one of those pieces you take into account and fall into that. I don't know. This one might be a little sketchy. Let's add another one. And this might be one of those times when the redundancy piece is acceptable. All right. I like it back to in my opinion, the bane of wilderness medicine education of everything's improvisation. And as long as you've got sticks and duct tape, we can do it. There's this time when you want to improvise and make things that you should already have with you. And just like that, there are certain times when additional backups are necessary. But you have to understand those, knowing the why, like Mike talked about at the very beginning, is you got to understand the why you're adding this extra piece. You don't know why, and you're just introducing it because you've always introduced it. Are you just making things more complicated for the sake of complication and because you've always done it that way, which is the great excuse, especially in the fire service? Yes. Or
what Captain told me to do. The PC says I have to do it this way.
Of your agency, then so be it.
Also, always follow your local protocols.
Or don't.
Or do whichever.
Yeah, I think that gets to the heart of it, though, is like your operating environment, what you're trying to do, what you have available, you need to have that base understanding of where a backup is needed, not necessarily. And just like you guys were saying it, but maybe I'm just recast from my point of view of that. I think that's the heart of the issue, is we're teaching all of this excess redundancy without understanding where it was actually necessary and why it was necessary where it is, as compared to just like you're saying, this is just how we were taught to do it. And this is how we're going to do it. And then we have instructors that are out there, and I always dog on some of these instructors that don't stay current with things. And this is an ever-changing world. And on top of that, now you're teaching techniques because somebody said you got to teach it without an understanding of why. So now we have that trickle-down effect of, we're just going to do this because it's how I was taught to do it. And the instructor said, I have to do it this way. And it's when you have 90% of your folks work in instructor departments, we're just going to call another engine crew to monkey gear up the stairs to wherever we needed to get it to out here in the backcountry. That's not a possibility. And like carrying a 90-pound pack for the sake of carrying a 90-pound pack for all the what-ifs is just not feasible.
I mean, to be fair, one of Sean's best quotes ever, needs to become a sticker. I need to make this happen. But we don't lift with our backs. We lift with our engine companies. So, yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, I disagree with both of you. You're wrong. Here's why. First off, to the first point of you shouldn't send the least experienced dude down the rope in an operational environment where single rope technique is necessary and they're not comfortable. You can move to things like lowering someone. I will argue it's been a failure of education and training to get them to that level of comfort, but they might be the only person available because you go to war with the army you have, not the army you want. And I've never been within the first 15 to 20 minutes of a response. I've never been in an environment where I'm like, dude, I got all the people and stuff I need. It just doesn't happen. So while I want to agree in principle, like that's not the guy that should be on the rope. The reality is whether it's look at it in the reverse, Sean. Think about the number of times where we've gone and we were the riggers. And the next thing we're doing patient care, right? It's because we came with that skill set as well. If your least prepared person is your most aptly equipped person to do the job at the end of the rope, they might be the ones that have to get on the dang rope.
And as me and Jason said, then that's a time when you probably should consider just lowering them. Vice putting them on there and say, you know, remember how your greedery works? Remember how your whatever device their descent device is? Remember how that works? Well, I'm not so sure. Because even if you have them on a belay and they head all up, are they then able to self-rescue to do a little up climb and untangle themselves or not?
You might have a really good point.
I understand that.
Also, it's not my emergency. Or it's
you
not,
might great yeah, paramedic and they're just really new to rope work. Mm-hmm. And they're perfect for the patient care part of it, getting down there, doing the initial resuscitation, stabilization, whatever it is. But if they're not comfortable on the rope, then that's when one of those things of, hey, all right, cool, hang out a minute, and we're going to set this up. We're going to lower you down. And it's like, all you're going to do is put two hands in front of you and hold onto the rope until your feet are on the ground again. And then this is the little thing you're going to unclip from yourselves, or depending on the environment, they might stay attached to that.
Mm-hmm.
But given the option,
I'm warming up to your perspective.
But again, and it does. It all goes back to training and everything else. All of these arguments for redundancy go to training. Like, why did you choose to go here when you knew there were potential even for some sharp edges, some heavier load, the potential for cutting a rope or other soft goods,
yeah,
etc.
Yeah.
We always do. And again, that goes back to there's always going to be a certain level of redundancy in a system just because you can never factor in the what if of sometimes shit just happens. But I think it's the over-engineering that we're arguing against.
I would agree with that one.
Yeah, I think I would too. All right, I'm wrong.
Let's just say you were out west and you needed somebody to, again, we'll pretend it's the medic, go down, make initial access and stuff. But it was really sketchy. Maybe some ice and some other scree and stuff like that. And there's a really strong potential that they could flip ball, get cocked up, whatever it is. Would you want to put a redundant, maybe a separate belay line on them at that point? Yeah, because Fireman might state that this is just going to be a little safer. Yeah, we're going to add a second rope to you, another point that you've got to put on your harness. But based on these conditions, this is why we'd want to do it, and you're justified in doing it. But to always put something on somebody just because we always put something else on somebody, I think, is the bullshit reason. You have to be able to know why you're putting that additional piece of something on there, not just because we always do it this way. Bullshit.
Yeah. All right. Okay. I was trying to find a counter argument, but I'm failing.
I think another good example is when you go out west and you work with teaching those guys, the law enforcement guys, protesters hanging from bridges and trees, there's a certain level of redundancy that you want in there because if you have somebody that's actively resisting you coming and they start monkeying with your gear, you're only on that one rope, you might want to have a redundant emergency belay that's on you. Things like that. So I would say there's certainly that might be beneficial. I don't think that should be the standard just because of a vigorous, but you never know. Then shit, man, you probably shouldn't even go. Because what if an earthquake happens?
Yeah, what if the world stops, right? Okay, I was trying to come up with a better counter argument, but it did not work out. I have failed.
just mean I get a patch. Right.
Yeah, you do get a patch. So I guess the key takeaway here is redundancy is great if there's a reason to be redundant, but I haven't heard one yet. I really haven't heard a strong argument for super extra triple redundancy because the NFPA says so. That's where,
you know what?
No, I'm gonna sum this up as it boils down to one thing. Learn your shit.
Well, there you go.
Understand what you're doing and why. Don't just say that's the way we've always done it, so that's the way we're gonna do it in the future. That's a dumb argument. I don't like it.
Agree.
Okay. Good talk.
Yeah. See? While you're doing the extra thing. Why are you?
Man. Absolutely.
Hell, I would say for people that are on rope and you don't know why you did the basic system the way you did it, you need to step back and continue your education. That's position dependent. Does the dude I'm going to lower down really need to know why I chose a 3-to-1 over a 5-to-1? Not really. But do the rest of the folks rigging the system need to know what we're doing and why? Probably. At least in a certain. But.
Well, it should come with that little bit of a checklist in your head of, okay, maybe we're going to need this, or we got a short haul or something like that, where it's, okay, I could get a little bit more force out of it. There still should be a little bit of an answer on the other side of the why, I would argue. But you may not know the specific checkbox that that person chose.
Go ahead, Mike. Sell us. I can see the gears.
No, I'm fine with it. I can't refute anything you're saying. I want to at a certain level, but I can't. But I will say that the obligate objective here is to know your shit. Know what you're doing, and then everything will be okay. But I think that's a pretty important aspect. Like, you need to know what you're doing.
Well, I would argue that's the most important aspect.
Yeah.
I would too. Just having the class and the paper is not good enough. It's the basement. It's not the end.
Yeah, if we want to put that in Mike's medical context, is the guy that just passed the registry this morning to do GTOS on the critical care patient tomorrow? He's a paramedic, right?
I mean, he totally is.
So, same thing. If you give him the choice, you're always going to choose your more experienced and knowledgeable person for the job, whether it's in rope rescue, doing your rigging, the guy going down, or your paramedic or your EMT going to do patient care. Picking the new one that may or may not know exactly what's going on probably isn't the best choice. Sometimes that's the only choice you got, and you got to work with what you got. In which case, if you know what you're doing on your end, say you're the guy doing the rigging topside, and say, Bobby, there's a real good medic. He's scared shitless on a rope. Bobby's not the guy that you should probably be sending down alone on some old school rescue 8, where if he lets go, he's going to keep on going. Or you put him on there with some sort of auto block, and when he cocks that up, does he know how to unpluck himself? At which point that you need to know what you're doing. If Mike's rigging it, so you know what? Let's just lower him down, right? A little bit longer to rig that system up and get things ready for him. But at the end of the day, that's probably the best choice. Anyway.
Yeah, you're right. In my head, I was going through, here's where my head was going. And I should probably take 7 seconds to explain this. We all know that it's going to take me more than 7 seconds. I am a huge advocate of getting attendance off the basket. So I'm thinking through the scenario of where somebody falls and went boom and is hurt at the bottom, and the best or only way out is by going up. I'm done with the model of we rig all this highly redundant dual mainline super whiz bang magical thing, and then we have an attendant that is attached to the basket at the master point along with the patient all loading the system for the hole. I'm a much bigger advocate of just toss another line and climb next to the patient under your own power, taking 50%+ of the load and the shock load and any potential struggle off of the haul system. I'm also, you heard it here first, folks. I think I'm actually pretty much done with moving people up a cliff in a supine position as well. We're going to talk about this more later. I spent some time in a basket this week after just going to FAST, which our podcast on that will be out before this one. But like all the science says laying people down for long periods of time, especially when the hurt is bad. You want to get their head up. You want to raise them. Yeah. So what do? We go, oh, this halt's going to take a while, buddy. We're going to go ahead and strap you down in a position where you cannot at all sit upright in any way, manner, shape, or form. And then we're going to manage your health and medical injuries. And so unless you really, truly need to be like bagging the dude, that is the only time. They should be on a vent. But
well, I was going to say that even if you were going to pretend to ride the basket and bag somebody, vertical would still be better in my opinion.
Just I agree. Because
lung physiology and laying somebody flat, you lose 50% or more of lung volume. So
yeah,
gravity keep those lungs open and elongated. How is that still a bad thing? So another discussion.
Yeah. So to get back to where I was disagreeing with you guys, my head kept going to, if my care provider is getting lower, that means they have to get hauled. And if I'm operating with a team of four or five people to try to execute this rescue, my rescuer that's at the bottom, which in most cases and will most likely be your highest certified, most skilled provider in a high acuity situation. But if they're the least capable rope rescue person, you can't really have them operating independently from the basket because they may not be capable of coming up. And then my head went to being an attendant is not just a passive ride. There's actually a certain level of skill and exposure to being able to be an attendant on a basket. And if you're not capable of doing that job because you can't even seem to rappel on a single rope, like how the hell are you going to come up with the basket and, you know, keep the system afloat? And then my brain went to, that's where all this redundancy comes into play, right? Because when you get the basket hooked on a haul system and then the next thing you know, you're over-tensioning the system and then you bend a carabiner, it happens. Blow out a becket on a pulley somewhere, however you're rigging this thing. But I can't in good conscience come back and argue with you guys and say, no, like just lower the guy. Like that actually does sound like the right answer. That's probably what should happen. And then you're just going to have to haul the dude up and or ask for more resources or hope for the best, improvise and overcome.
Again, the two ends of this spectrum here of the ideal, where single rope systems and good quality trained responders at all levels to go. And we've got a couple of dudes that really know what they're doing with rigging ropes, and that's about it. So everybody else has just got to be able to fill in where needed and be able to follow simple instructions, whether that's, all right, Bob, you've never gone down the rope before on your own, so here's what you're going to do. Trust us. It's like riding the stair chair when you tell the old lady, don't reach out and grab stuff. Don't reach out and grab stuff. Hold on. And what most of us probably deal with is somewhere in that in between, right? You've got a few dudes that really know what they're doing here. You got a couple guys that might be really good here. And then generally, I won't say we get lucky, but we get lucky and it all works out. So it goes back to, is everybody trained? Is trained as well as they can be and should be? Which I would argue that unless you're working with a group of PJs or somebody else where you just prep for the 100% every time you go out, you're never going to get that usual on the rescue side with the rest of us.
That would have been a cool job.
Right? When your job every year is to go through a recertification training cycle where you do all of these things, and at the end, like, is about as proficient as you're going to get for this, where you're at in your life. Yeah, life's great. We can go out and do all these things. But for the rest of us that get, for you and I, seasonal employees that have never done any of this work, now they're being tossed into helping set up and manage haul systems. And things like that, right? It's Jason probably never knows what he gets when he's out there on a fire line that certain crews. Some guys he's going to get that are squared away, been doing this for a while. And then might get the brand new person who's just met minimum qualifications and said, hey, here's another dude. Make sure you don't kill anybody today.
Happens all the time.
It's always the FNG, huh?
Yep. And I spend 14 days training them and they go off to another team and I never see him again.
You're welcome. He's a good guy. I think, again, it all goes back to the mention at the very beginning, the whole training piece. Everybody's got to be trained. And then there are times when you've got to do that extra bit of redundancy. Like, instead of your tenant going down single rope by himself, maybe we need to put that belay line on as just in case, right? The odds of him having a rock fall on his head and losing consciousness or suddenly having a seizure, hopefully slim. But if the situation, like, it's one of those, like I said, ice and scree and some really just nasty terrain, okay, maybe that might be a good idea. So let's put an extra on this guy. And chances are it's not going to be necessary, but there's going to be that 1 in 10 or so that, yeah, good thing we did this time because, man, this is what happened. And then there are certain environments where it's, we've done this so many times, our kit is good to go, we know how we rig, we know where we rig, and you can get away with not having to have some of these addition systems. So I think it about training and experience, and the way to get that is to do it, and there's just not enough people doing it on the regular, I think, that are out there involved in these operations. Think about that. Like, the people we graduate from that tech rescue program, they get it the briefest of exposures to all of it. And some of, simply because there's only 5 days available training and you only get 40 hours to do it in. Actually, we don't even get 40 hours, right? You get like 36, only so much you can train them on. And they're just getting little bits of exposure to a broad spectrum of things. And a lot of those people go back, and because they've graduated that course, they might be considered the duty expert because they've got that piece of paper and they barely got a grasp on the fundamentals, let alone even intermediate or master level knowledge of where and when they should be doing certain things. So it's a challenge.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
You're good, brother. Yeah. Just to go off of that point, we had one come to camp this year. And she was like, hey, we need to be doing this more often. We need to be this. I don't want to be on one of the teams this year because I don't think people are proficient enough. Then we start questioning her and say, what did you do in the OSCE practice? Did you play the systems? No. Okay. Is it a team problem or is it a you problem too, that you don't feel comfortable and don't want to be embarrassed? So I 100% agree with it. There's a huge training component here. And I don't think enough people out there understand that piece of paper is the basement. I said that 100 times on our side of things on the podcast. And that's one of the overarching things, is like the piece of paper you get from any course is the basement. It's never everything.
Yeah, it's just a piece of paper, which doesn't make you smart. It makes you a dude with a piece of paper. We didn't really talk about redundancy per se, but we did talk about not being stupid. And that's way more important than having redundancy. If you can have both, that's great. Sean's heard me vent enough times about we're just adding stuff to add stuff. It's not adding any value. And that comes from knowing your equipment and knowing what you're doing, not just banging stuff in. You can add as much redundancy as you want. You can add all the hardware you want because that's what the boss man says or that's what the rules say. But at the end of the day, if you don't know how to use it and you don't know how to operate in the environment, it doesn't matter how much equipment you add, something is going to get broken and somebody's going to get hurt. Or something's going to get rigged improperly, right? You can have 4 stitch plates and 87 carabiners, and if they're not anchored properly and the anchor fails, it doesn't really matter how much hardware was attached to that tree when you're done for. So, anything else, gentlemen?
You've heard me right there.
One of you say something again, because I heard both of you talking at exactly the same time and couldn't tell what either one of you said.
You get the last word, Jason.
Oh, it's all good. It's your show, man. But yeah, I got nothing to add.
All right, gentlemen, then I'm going to hit the stop button.
If you have any questions or comments or ideas for show topics, you can send us an email at theshow@emsonthemountain.com or hit us up on social media. We can be found on Facebook and Instagram at EMS on the Mountain, Twitter at EMSOTM, or you can engage with us and a whole community of wilderness EMS professionals at locals.com/wilderness EMS.
Until the next episode, thanks for joining us, and until we see you on the mountain, train hard, be safe, and do good work.